This is Lost and Found. I'm Jonathan Green, and this week, The Office. You work in an office. I have pretty much all my working life, which has been in journalism. So that's a special kind of office, I guess. But most offices, you know, their nature is determined to some extent by the thing that happens there or the technology that gets used, the things that are employed to make whatever it is you make, whether that's ideas, words, stuff. Genevieve Bell is a distinguished professor at the ANU's College of Engineering and Computer Science. Genevieve, our modern office, how much is it determined by the technology that we have to deploy there?
Oh, listen, that's a really good question, Jonathan. I think you actually have to think about the history of the office and the history of the technologies in it, right? They've in some ways grown up together and have, I don't want to say co-evolved exactly, but they have certainly been in forms of interdependence. I mean, you can look back to the kind of foundations of the modern office in the 1800s and the proliferation of paper and technologies of paper and managing early inventory created things like the typewriter, which led to the notion of having to have a filing cabinet, which led to the idea of places to put the paper.
And the in-tray, suddenly, the out-tray.
Well, yeah, and the filing cabinet and the filing room and the person who moved the paper around. And suddenly, you know, a small object, the typewriter, created this entire kind of complexity. And electricity did a not dissimilar thing, and the same with computers. And I think we're at another one of those kind of moments now where we're having interesting conversations about the nature of the built infrastructure in an office and even does your office need to belong to the person for whom you work, or is it going to be one of these shared workspaces? You know, can you take your office home on the road? And there's this kind of interesting uncoupling of office from physical building and built world. And I think all of those things are kind of interesting and complicated moments to navigate.
I mean, there's a whole lot there, and so many possibilities are suddenly possible. Is there a single sort of strand of technology that is determining a lot of our current thinking around the office?
Listen, I think you sort of need to be careful here too about whether we're talking about the kind of office space once characterized by desks and a kind of what we would in the 21st century, I hate to say, call knowledge work versus a whole lot of other places where people do jobs.
Yep.
So if we're just kind of thinking about that kind of former office space, probably one of the biggest transformations in the last 20 years was both the appearance of the internet and then the internet no longer being a thing with a fixed wire but becoming wireless. So you could then connect into the services and infrastructures both of your office and other places but not have to be attached to a particular place. And so if you think about the kind of arc from the internet to the web to Wi-Fi to mobile broadband and then to the devices following that, right, of going from fixed desktops to laptops to smartphones and a bundle of other things, that transition has really shaped and changed the way we think about offices, but it's also made for an inordinate amount of complexity, right? Who is responsible when the network doesn't work? How do you know the network's not working? Who is troubleshooting the problems? Now that you can carry your office anywhere, what does that mean about how you manage the seams and boundaries in your life between certain kinds of roles? And I think all of that complexity is ongoing.
There's an interesting tension between the move towards the redundancy of the fixed office to which we all attend, and on the other side of the coin, the office which attempts to be workplace, home place, meeting place, sleeping place, eating place, to remove that work-life boundary.
Well, listen, I think one of the interesting things is there's always this tension between what I think of as a fantastical engineering imagination or a fantasy in some ways of this notion that what we're all really after is seamlessness, right? Things should seamlessly move from one place to another or should be seamless. And that sounds great until you think about it and then realize that for many human beings, the seams are actually really important. By that, I mean the bit where you dress a little bit differently on weekends than maybe during the week. You sound a little bit different when you're talking to your friends or your family than you do when you're talking to your coworkers. You use a different email address. You may want to behave in a different way. You may kind of move in and out of these different kinds of being of yourself. And when everything is seamless, it's a little harder to protect those seams. And actually sort of navigating those has always been an important part of how we manage multiple demands. And when the technology just follows or has the capacity to follow, it creates interesting challenges, everything from traditional security challenges to ideas about when are you ever really off the clock. My sense is that there's often been a conflict between what is possible to engineer and what humans actually want to encounter.
What happens when the various working realities become virtual?
Listen, I think some really interesting things happen, and the inevitability of that switch is less clear, I think, in 2019 than it felt maybe even 5 years ago. I've started to watch with interest in some large corporations in Europe, for instance, where they have actually reintroduced really interesting things like office hours. So I can think of at least one big company in Europe who realized that their health and mental well-being of their employees was ill-served by being connected 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so they actually set up a protocol to turn off the email servers at 5 p.m. on a Friday afternoon and not turn them back on again until Monday morning at 9 a.m. And so the notion that the technology inevitably means we all need to be always available is actually not what's playing out. And we also see manifestations of physical stuff even against the backdrop of things going virtual. So, you know, I can think of another big company in Southeast Asia who don't let their laptops go home on weekends with their employees. The idea being you should have time that's actually kept away from these physical objects.
I wonder too whether we really want to work or whether we really want to play, and which of those spaces is perhaps our most creative.
Listen, I think it depends on the job type, on the moment in a particular life, of the kind of work that's being done and that needs to get done. We certainly know from a bunch of studies that have been done about work, and both creative work and even the kind of more mundane and banal work, that there are things that increase satisfaction on the job, that increase the kind of caliber of the work that is being done. We know that that is things like having a workplace that has a range of different voices in it. So, you know, the plug for having a more diverse workforce. We know that for that to work, it has to actually have practices around inclusivity. There is certainly evidence to suggest that workplaces that have different kinds of spaces in them, so both traditional, more office-like spaces, but places where there are other things. Some emerging literature coming out of the US that I've seen that suggests that having access to windows, light, and plants increases people's sense of what is possible. The jury, interestingly, however, is really out on some other things. So I know we've gone to a rash of open plan spaces over the last, well, really 50 years. The data is more ambiguous about the relative merits of open plan versus enclosed spaces for productivity. And I think that's one where there's just not been enough rigorous data to think about even how you test that, right? But I think that's been one where there's more ambivalence than you would expect.
I suspect that if there are people out there listening to this in an open, a flexible work environment, they will be nodding in silent agreement.
With their headphones on. While there's all the usual technology we know about, Jonathan, like Wi-Fi and the move to mobile devices, there's also been a real push to have smart things in the office. I think my favorite, and I use that word cautiously there, but my favorite of those recently has been a company, actually Nissan in Japan, who were piloting smart chairs. And what made them smart was that they went back to their original location at the end of every day. So at 5 p.m., if you found yourself in this Japanese office, all the chairs would be running back to the desks that they were supposed to be at.
What if you were still sitting in one?
I have no idea. It's one of those things. But like I said, I find it fantastical and I'm not quite sure what to do with it. But the videos of it on the internet are completely excellent.
I love the autonomously rearranging office is a splendid idea. Genevieve, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Genevieve Bell is a distinguished professor at the ANU. My first little office, and this is a very long time ago, was in a newspaper building, the Herald and Weekly Times building in a Melbourne. And it was the office of a paper called the Sporting Globe, now defunct. And it was desks, it was telephones, it was typewriters, it was people constantly smoking, me included, and butting out their cigarettes on the floor or on the table or in ashtrays or on the edges of plastic bins by your desk. I spent probably my first 15 years as a sub-editor and journalist convinced that I really couldn't be productive unless I was smoking. And that's pretty much one of the things that I determined the character of those early offices. They were foul, fetid, noisy, stinking places. I mean, you underestimate now how quiet the modern office is, the little tip-tap, pitter-patter of computer keyboards. People get annoyed if someone next to you takes a phone call. I mean, sorry, people, you should go back 15 years. The place was a racket. The phones were loud. The typewriters were banging. People were shouting at each other. It was a very different work environment. So, Buffy, what's in your lunch salad today?
Well, Jonathan, tucked in my little take-home container made of glass, I have some grated carrot, grated zucchini, there's some bok choy, kale, frika, feta, toasted hazelnuts, roasted red peppers, regular red peppers, and some marinated tofu that I marinated last night in some soy sauce, some garlic and ginger, and a little bit too much hot red pepper. It was pretty good.
Daphne Mohajevapesaran is a lecturer in fashion design at RMIT University. Daphne, I often wonder whether we shouldn't just wear a uniform to work. Wouldn't that make it easier?
You know, I really think it would make it easier, but it wouldn't be as fun.
What's the history? I mean, is it about, I mean, and it varies, I suspect, whether your workplace is customer focused, whether you're meeting members of the public, whether you're trying to make an impression, or whether you're just slopping around in beanbags in the IT sector.
Well, I guess that idea of, you know, looking professional and looking clean and looking uniform comes from the Industrial Revolution and looking like part of the machine, you know? And to me, it sort of erases your humanity a little bit and makes you part of the company. The three-piece suit itself, I guess, which is what we're used to seeing in the office, has been around for hundreds of years. And it came from 17th century French court wear, actually. So it's always had this connection with formality.
If we take this back 50, 60, 70, 80 years, there would have been a certain uniformity. People would have been at desks, people would have been in buildings, people would have been banging away at typewriters and smoking cigarettes and pretty much wearing similar things.
I wonder, though, if that relaxation of the rules of formal dress comes across different aspects of our lives and it sort of also enters the workplace. We're allowed now to wear hats in a movie theater, for example.
I wonder, because it is a place in which we spend a lot of time, our sense of style, our sense of self, how much of it, I wonder, is determined by what we are able to wear in the workplace. It's such a significant part of our lives.
So I've been living in Japan for many years, and I've just recently moved to Australia. And in Japan, all school students wear school uniforms, which was a new phenomenon for me because I'm from Canada, and I'd never wore a school uniform. And when they go into the workplace, they're also expected to wear uniforms, and quite formal, quite pared back. And when you're talking about individual identity, not really showing that, encouraged not to show it, even in the hairstyle and use of makeup. And I think for a lot of people, it's sort of just expected that you wear this uniform and you're in society and you're a member of the team, so to speak. So it's not a place for you to kind of express your individuality too much because you're a member of the team.
It's very, very deep sort of cultural stuff here. I wonder if office culture changes office fashion or whether office fashion can change office culture.
I think office culture can definitely change office fashion, and you can have, you know, trends set within your specific office culture as well. Perhaps your boss really likes a specific designer. You'll find that the people that work under this boss also tend to start to like that designer. There's small little ecologies of ideas, I suppose, in an office. And if I could share one more sort of anecdote about Japan, there's when we're talking about being allowed to dress in certain ways, there was a government-mandated initiative called Cool Biz that started in 2005, where because the rules, the formal rules for dress are so kind of strong in the office that people were wearing their blazers and jackets in the summer and they were cranking the air conditioners. So in order to save energy, the Ministry of the Environment, they instigated a rule called Cool Biz, allowing people and sort of mandating that people wear short sleeve shirts to the office. every day in the summer. So no more jackets and short sleeves and no ties. And they said it was from May until October, and it cut energy costs hugely.
Very sensible. Daphne, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Daphne Mahajavapasaran. She's a lecturer in fashion design. Now, in my modern office, I come in the morning and I go to my bright metal plate locker and I pull out my crafty office-supplied felt bag where my laptop is and my teacup and my tea and a couple of notebooks, all the things that I might once have personalised my workspace with, but no longer, for I work in a flexible work environment where really no one's desk is their desk and no one's space is their own because their space is everyone's. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that keeps us flexible. Maybe that has an impact on the way we think about our work. Or maybe it just reduces us to some sort of soulless automaton. I don't know.
Hannah, what do you have for lunch?
At the moment, I've been doing this kind of deconstructed Caesar salad. So I love a Caesar salad. I mean, what's not to love? Some of my favourite elements are in it. You know, we've got bacon, we've got eggs, we've got croutons, gluten-free for me, obviously. We've got chicken, and we've got parmesan, my favourite cheese. Anyway, I've been making like a healthy version of it. So I've taken the chicken out, the croutons out, the bacon out. And what do I have left? I have a salad, and then you just begin with a lettuce, like romaine or rocket or spinach. And then I've been putting chickpeas. That's kind of my chicken sort of substitute, chicken, chickpeas. Do you see the relationship? Then a red onion, some peas or green beans. And then I've kept the boiled egg and the parmesan. So it's like a healthy version of a Caesar salad. It's quite easy to make.
It's not a Caesar salad at all.
I think we're getting caught up in semantics.
Steve Costa is Managing Director of Hassell Studio Design Practice. Rob Backhouse is the Head of Interior Design. What are the key issues in modern workplace design these days?
Designing workplaces is about how you enable that work environment or that organisation to be better at what they're trying to do. So the issues that are playing out in their business are the issues that affect the designing the spaces for them.
That presupposes a big process there of conversation and investigation into what they do and how they do it.
And understanding how they can do it better from a big picture level all the way down to an individual person's experience and contribution.
Steve, does that often come as a bit of a revelation to those people? Does this sort of throw their work up into a new light?
Absolutely, because so many people only know the workplaces that they know. They only know the office that they've worked in. So often people don't understand just how different it could be if you rethought it from the beginning again and tried to make it better.
Well, that's interesting, Rob. I mean, not many people have the luxury of moving into a brand new workplace. Mm. And I imagine that this is an easier process if that's what you're doing.
Well, it sounds easy, but I think what people really are challenged by often is imagining a future that doesn't exist yet. So our job in the interrogation and the analysis and all the engagement and interviewing people is not just to say, what are you doing now that I need to understand? What might you be doing in 2, 5, 10 years? So you're then leading them to a kind of future that people actually often go, oh, that sounds a bit scary, or I'm not convinced by that. But, you know, we have to kind of synthesize all of these different demands from current to future to technological and so on.
A lot of that must rest in the technology, and that's so unpredictable. How do you then imagine that in a purposeful way for people now? How do you leave that open-ended enough to adapt?
Well, it's adapting quicker and quicker as well over time. So the change is speeding up, which makes it even harder. So I guess in the past, you used to design things that were designed ready to change when required, whereas now change is just constant. And so the design of these places is being designed to be constantly changing and reorganizing itself and refreshing. So organizations really have got much more fluid and dynamic internally, and the spaces have to reflect and enable that.
Technology has released people from having to be in one place. So I think your ability to move between spaces to concentrate or collaborate or interact or be isolated are much easier because of technology.
And yet we still want to be in a place.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I wonder if the next thing is to lose the place altogether.
As that technology has changed and allow you to work in that different way, the role that the office plays has changed as a result of that, and is less about functionally facilitating some of the tasks and much more about what you belong to or want to belong to. Why do you want to be part of that organisation in the first place? Why do you identify with its work? Why is it meaningful to you? And how can you feel like you're a part of it? So I think that's no coincidence that that's why a lot of the workspaces have become more about belonging to that collective mission or purpose, you know, and being with other people who share the same values as you.
The social dimension.
And are working on that same mission. And so the spaces are really a symbolism of that as much as anything else.
But we get to that issue too, the tricky one of work-life balance that we hear a lot about. And I wonder how much of that being a problem is created by the vast differential between workspace and home space.
Yes, absolutely.
And the modern workspace aims to resolve some of that disconnection.
Yeah, that's right, because the binaries are false binaries. Open plan or an office, it's a false binary. There's actually a blend of things you need between, you know, from very open collaborative space all the way through to very focused, concentrated space. Same with your work-life balance. There's sometimes where you need to be absolutely focused on what you're doing, and other times where you can do that in and amongst other things while you're shopping or doing something else, and it's a blend. And that's the complexity of modern work, both in terms of how it integrates with your life, but also where you happen to be while you're doing those things. It can happen, you know, you can be working in the back of the taxi or on the plane or at the airport or in a hotel or in a bar or in the office.
We talk about form and function and which leads the other. How much does design lead the activity? How much is the activity led by the design?
It's probably both. I think there's the symbols and the messages that come from design that sort of then elicit behaviour. Sometimes, you know, cues and visuals and, you know, their form maybe in, you know, letting people know what the function is available or possible and so on and so forth. But equally, if it doesn't work, if the space does not function for what you've said you need and what is valuable, it can look as good as you like and it's not going to work. You know, build it and they will come doesn't work. So we talk a lot about trying to design more now the experience of the workplace and your experience at
so
work.
What does that mean in detail?
Well, I think thinking about not just, oh, we need, you know, 10 desks with seats and 3 meeting rooms and just, you know, the kind of only functional needs of the traditional work activities, but what's my experience when I arrive and come and, you know, what do I do first? Do I get a coffee? Do I talk to a, you know, a colleague? What information am I gathering and processing and using and trying to get it much more at a human-centered level where you're thinking about every 5 minutes maybe through a day and coming in and out of that environment and so on and so forth.
Head of design Rob Backhouse and Steve Costa, Managing Director from Hassell Studios.
Hilary, what are you having for lunch today?
I am having the great tradition of leftovers, and today it is a chicken in its third incarnation as pasta with zucchini and olive oil and pepper and parmesan cheese with a handful of spinach thrown in and I think maybe some corn kernels.
That sounds pretty good and healthy.
In the end product it was. It started out looking not very healthy at all and then it had extra things and I'm happy with it now.
Of course, not everybody in those early offices worked out on a floor full of cigarette smoke and coffee dregs. At the Herald and Weekly Times, there was a place on the third floor called Mahogany Row. That's because it was a place of wood panelling, of doors with brass plates, of secretaries, of eminences within, where one might knock and one might enter. And then there would be an office. Solo inhabitant, probably also smoking, maybe a pipe, because that had a certain sort of class and gravitas. But that's where the executive class lived, against the windows, on that windowed wall, surrounded by wood, and a sense of, well, authority. You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production. You heard from Hassell Studios, Head of Design Rob Backhouse and Steve Costa, Managing Director. Genevieve Bell, Distinguished Professor at the ANU College of Engineering and Computer Science. And Daphne Mahajavapasaran, Lecturer in Fashion Design at RMIT University. Producers are Mira Adligillis and Buffy Gorilla. technical production by Chrissy Miltiadu. I'm Jonathan Green.